Mr. Hug, good morning to you. And Ms. Vincent, good morning to you. Do either of you have questions before we begin? Then, Mr. Hug, you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. Jerry Hug on behalf of the appellant Brendan Boone. I was appointed by the District Court of Douglas County to represent Mr. Boone after the Public Defender's Office was allowed to withdraw. Mr. Boone wanted to pursue a motion to withdraw his pleas and use as part of, or as the basis for that motion, a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Excuse me. Before I get started, I apologize to the court for the reliance as stated, as pointed out by the state, on the withdrawn version of the Gonzalez opinion. As counsel of record, that was my responsibility to make sure that that was an accurate citation, and certainly did not intend to rely on a withdrawn opinion. But regardless, I think Gonzalez too echoes what we were looking at in the original Gonzalez as far as what's relevant to this case. Just because of the series of cases that were cited, both in Gonzalez 1 and then referenced, that citation was referenced to by this court in Gonzalez 2, starting with State versus Lewis and State versus Evans back in the 70s.
So do you read Gonzalez 2 as saying the withdrawal of plea that you're requesting isn't available if you've got other options?
No, I read Gonzalez 2 as being applicable to Ms. Gonzalez because of the status of her case, the procedural status of her case. Her case was open, I think the phrase is, it was after her judgment became final for purposes of collateral attack. In our case, it's before, it's after sentencing, but before Mr. Boone, judgment is open for collateral attack at that point.
When does a judgment become open for collateral attack?
In Gonzalez 2, I believe the decision was after the direct appeal. And I believe there were a couple of other cases that the court talked about in Gonzalez 2 that were procedurally different than ours. There was one case, Holton, that came back on a federal habeas review. It was a murder case. And certainly that was already in collateral attack at that point in time.
What's the statutory authority for a court to allow a defendant to withdraw a plea after sentencing?
In this case, well, generally there's the statutory authority that's driven mostly out of the immigration advisements that are given.
But that's not relevant here.
No, this is a common law. Common law, and that's what the discussion is, and there's that line of cases from Evans.
So you're not relying on a statute.
No.
You're relying on a judicially recognized procedure to withdraw a plea after sentencing.
Correct.
And why should that be judicially recognized?
Because I think it has been judicially recognized through the line of cases that have been cited in both the Gonzalez opinions, Lewis and Evans. Evans is probably the closest on point for us. The discussion is regarding the common law, non-statutory common law procedure that's derived out of formed in part out of the ABA standards for guilty pleas. And that's been recognized in multiple cases, 8 or 9 cases that were cited by this court.
What have we said about those ABA standards relating to guilty pleas and other contexts? Haven't we backed away from those as stating the governing law?
There is one case that affirmatively disavows 1 section 3.3, but the relevant section in regard to the line of cases that are relevant for Mr. Boone's appeal have to do with 2.1. And while there has been no kind of codification of those are looked at under the manifest injustice part of the test here.
You would agree that the American Bar Association is not a substitute for the legislature of the
Correct.
State.
Correct.
And consequently, it has those recommendations or suggestions have no legislative or weight of law, of statutory law, in our jurisprudence, right?
Correct.
I would like one quick clarification, and maybe I just missed it somewhere. The sentencing occurred on November 16, 2022.
Correct.
And then the motion to withdraw was filed on December 2, 2022.
Correct.
When was the motion denied or overruled?
December 6th, the motion was denied. The hearing was held on December 5th in support of the motion.
And so, and when was the notice of appeal filed?
Notice of appeal was filed the 13th of December.
So that was within 30 days of everything?
We were scrambling to try to get everything done before the 30 days, trust
okay.
me.
All right.
With the number of parties involved and things that needed to be done.
Well, thank you. What was our rationale for recognizing a common law right to withdraw a plea in Gonzales 2?
The rationale for, I don't know that there was a discussion about the rationale. I think Gonzales 2, at least the way I read Gonzales 2, spent more time dealing with procedurally where Ms. Gonzales was.
But I guess what I have in mind is there's some discussion in Gonzales 2 that this procedure is, or this, the circumstances under which this procedure can be used are going to be very limited, and it's going to be limited to those circumstances where the Constitution requires a remedy of some kind and there's no other remedy provided in statute. You recall that?
Currently available remedy, I believe.
Right.
Yes, and there was a discussion about the very, very narrow application of this, and one of those is a constitutional violation, which is relevant in Mr. Boone's case because the allegation is...
But there was another remedy available here, right? You could have filed a direct appeal, asserted ineffective assistance of counsel, probably isn't going to be resolved on that direct appeal on that record, but then post-conviction is available, is it not? Withdrawing the plea was not the only remedy, not the only mechanism available to remedy the alleged ineffective assistance of counsel.
It was not the only available remedy, but the motion to withdraw the plea was an allowed remedy, and which was obviously at the wish of the defendant that he wanted to proceed that way.
Allowed a remedy under American Bar Association standards and the cases cited in Gonzales,
well,
too?
I don't think that the American Bar Association standards necessarily allow it. It's the framework within which the other cases from Nebraska have looked and said, well, these are the few circumstances.
So rules for withdrawing a plea, must those be done by the legislature?
I don't know the answer to that. If there's a specific rule that binds the process, I think you could get guidance from the legislature or from this court as far as a rulemaking body goes. But the rules of evidence are statutory, and I would assume that that type of authority would have to be statutory. That kind of rulemaking authority, excuse me.
Haven't we said as a general rule that where a criminal procedure is not authorized by statute, it is not available to a defendant in a criminal proceeding?
Generally, but I think this is an exception to that rule because it's been used frequently without that becoming an issue or a reason for denial of said motion or appeal, reversal of appeal, or I'm not aware of any case where that's happened.
Thank you.
There were some cases in Gonzales where we recognized that this procedure existed, but doesn't Gonzales too cut back on that a little bit? I mean, how much weight can you put on the precedent that you're following here?
And I will tell you, in all honesty, I did not focus on Gonzales too from the standpoint that I believe that Gonzales too was different enough because of where Ms. Gonzales was in her process. And I thought that Evans in that type of case where there was before sentencing or after sentencing before resolution through appeal and then being open to collateral attack, I thought those cases were more in line. with what the fact pattern is here.
But you're here on direct appeal. Within 30 days of all of the things that might be the judgment or a subsequent final order, right?
Correct.
Then you've only assigned error as to the refusal to allow your client to withdraw his plea.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent and I represent the appellee. Before I begin, I want to flag a potential jurisdictional issue. It occurred to me that the order from which Boone appealed is not a final order under Gonzalez or any other case that I'm aware of. He did, however, file his appeal within 30 days after the judgment was entered and could have assigned as error the district court's denial of his motion. So whether this court has jurisdiction depends in part on how it construes his appeal. With that understanding, I'll address the one claim that he raised, namely whether the district court erred by denying his motion to withdraw his plea. As I argued in my brief, I don't believe Boone's motion was procedurally proper. Since this court's reasoning in Gonzalez counsels against maintaining or adopting a similar common law procedure under the circumstances presented here. And by way of background, the manifest injustice claim or common law procedure was taken from the ABA standards relating to guilty pleas, which this court adopted in 1971 and followed throughout the 70s and early 80s. It reads like a post-conviction provision, and although we already had a post-conviction act at that time, there was very little discussion about the interplay between the two.
So regardless of the wisdom of Gonzalez too, is this correct that one of the opportunities to withdraw would be that post-conviction is not and never was available?
Correct.
Does this case fit that description?
I believe so, yes. And that's why I think the reasoning in Gonzalez is like, well, it's only available if there's no other avenue available to you and it's constitutionally mandated.
Well, to be clear, as I understood Judge Miller-Lerman's question, are you conceding that this defendant never had the opportunity for post-conviction?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, if I misunderstood your question, no. I mean, obviously he has that before him.
Okay.
He entered his plea.
Maybe we're going to merge Justice Papik's inquiry, my inquiry, and Justice Castle's inquiry, and assuming that Gonzalez, too, is the law for purposes of the question, do the facts of this case fit within the parameters of a permitted opportunity to move to withdraw?
Well, I mean, her conviction was final, so it was essentially a collateral attack. Mm-hmm. And so the question then became, well, could she have availed herself of these other remedies? He's in a procedurally, you know, different posture because he was sentenced. He hadn't even taken a direct appeal yet.
Right.
And obviously post-conviction had not been, is not on the table because his conviction
is not
final.
It's not a never was available.
Is it a never will be? I mean, do we have to extend Gonzalez to say it's is not... Never was, never will be?
No. And I think the question here, you know, when you're talking about common law remedies and that sort of thing, I think the court's been careful about circumscribing the availability of those types of remedies and creating remedies, especially in the post-conviction context. I know a couple of times you've been asked to do so in order to avoid time bars, and you have declined to do so.
But you'd agree, Mr. Boone, there was a remedy or is a remedy available to him through direct appeal and post-conviction to assert ineffective assistance of counsel in the context of entering a plea.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, then in 1986, and just to kind of touch on, you know, these ABA standards and their applicability, it was in 1986 the State v. Irish where this court, you know, expressly disavowed any adherence to the ABA standards and stated that they are and never were part of Nebraska's law. And then after that point, that manifest injustice language largely disappeared from the case law until it resurfaced in the immigration consequences context, which brings us to Gonzalez. And now at the time Gonzalez was decided, there had been significant developments in the post-conviction law, and I think perhaps the Post-Conviction Act was on the court's radar in a way that maybe it wasn't in the 70s and 80s, but in any event, you know, the act figured prominently in the court's analysis because in Gonzalez, she was, you know, it was a collateral attack on a final judgment. But I think it's equally relevant here, since the ultimate issue is whether Boone has a forum in which to vindicate his constitutional claim, which he does. You know, by now it's well settled that a defendant who enters a plea is limited to challenging whether the plea was voluntary or resulted from ineffective assistance of counsel. Those are the only two grounds, and both can be addressed either on direct appeal or in a post-conviction proceeding, which essentially renders the common law procedure superfluous because it's duplicative. Plus, the common law procedure creates procedural issues that would not otherwise exist. For example, you know, does a motion to withdraw a plea toll the time for filing a direct appeal? Or, you know, does it operate as a procedural bar to a future post-conviction proceeding? It also affects the state's ability to appeal an adverse ruling, since we can appeal only if it's a collateral attack, which this is not. And beyond that, it creates an inequity among defendants, since defendants who go to trial don't have a similar mechanism by which they can fast-track their ineffective assistance claims. Instead, they're limited to direct appeal and collateral attack, and defendants who enter pleas should be as well. It's also worth noting here that the feds experimented with this same dual proceeding for withdrawing a plea after sentencing. One was a motion under Rule 32, and the other was a 2255, which is a post-conviction motion. In 1983, they amended Rule 32 to eliminate that procedure because although the grounds for both motions were the same, courts were applying different standards, which produced inconsistent results, so it quickly became more trouble than it was worth. The amended Rule 32 is now Rule 11E, which provides that after sentence is imposed, a defendant may move to set aside a plea only on direct appeal or collateral attack, which is the position that I'm advocating. I believe that's the most principled approach, and it appears to be consistent with the history.
And so 2255 is kind of the closest thing.
Sure.
Okay.
To our post-conviction.
To our post-conviction. Thank you.
Right. But I think it's consistent with the history and development of our own law up to this point, so it's not like I'm proposing some radical departure here. But if, however, the court disagrees and finds the motion was proper, the state submits the case needs to be remanded to the district court. There was an evidentiary hearing. The court didn't make any factual findings or do any legal analysis, and I believe both are necessary here. So I don't have anything further, so unless there are questions.
Are there cases that we have to overrule to reach the result you're advocating for? And what I have in mind is Gonzalez 2, in discussing Gonzalez 1,
yeah,
sort of talked about a series of those cases from the 70s that were cited and said, well, there were seven of them in this footnote and two of them in this footnote. What's your read on the viability of those categories of cases?
Well, the first thing that happened was, my first reaction when I got this rule was, you can't do this. I don't know how this is possible or how it fits with the other, you know, the rest of the scheme that we have for filing direct appeal and post-conviction act and requiring them to raise their. So I went back and tried to figure out where the manifest injustice standard began, and that's when I figured out it came from the ABA standards. Because I read all of the cases that were cited in that footnote in Gonzalez 1. And all of those occurred before Irish, and there's no mention of Irish anywhere in Gonzalez. And so I think when the court...
In either Gonzalez, there's no mention of Irish in either Gonzalez 1 or Gonzalez 2?
No. Not that I recall, but, you know, in Irish, I mean, the court couldn't have been any clearer because that was a case in which, you know, as we're all familiar, where the court adopted the standards for determining when a plea is voluntary, but the statement couldn't have been any clearer, saying, well, to the extent that we've said that these are, you know, governing principles or that we've adopted them in any form, that's disapproved. That's not true. Here's the standard, and then a year later in Minchell, they came back and said, you know, the court came back and said, okay, you know, they mentioned the manifest injustice standard in passing, which I kind of found curious given Irish, but then it went on to say that, you know, to again reject those standards and then say, well, here's the standard for determining when you can withdraw a plea prior to sentencing. And
should we be reading manifest injustice regardless of the merits of the ABA stuff, right, as a constitutional issue?
Well, I suppose, because that was the question I had, again, was I'm not sure how this manifest injustice standard survived Irish. And, you know, like I said, it came back up, and I think first in Yoshigil. It might have come up once in a Court of Appeals case, but they resolved it on statutory grounds. And it came up in Yoshigil, and then it came up again in Gonzalez, but this reference was kind of back related back to these standards, because that's the only place I can find the manifest injustice standard was from the ABA standards. So I thought, well, to the extent those have been disapproved, I'm not sure exactly how this survived, but to the extent that it did, you know, I mean, Gonzalez was certainly decided on constitutional grounds. And I think the court has said before that, you know, where a procedure is not available by statute, it's unavailable, but there's a narrow exception to that, which is unless it's constitutionally mandated. I think it was Rodriguez-Torres where where the court pointed that out. So I think, you know, I'm not attacking Gonzalez by any means and saying that it was incorrect. I'm just saying that I think that the basic reasoning as to what remedies are available to you, if they're statutory, then why are we relying on a common law procedure when you have these other remedies that are available to you? So that's basically my complaint. But if there are no further questions, I'll just submit the matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Hug, thank you for your service. And counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus Boone. Yes. You are excused. And the next case of the day then is Karras versus Karras.